Tommy, Tom Esker. Bunker, right here in north central Indiana, transmitting to the world. Button there. How about that? Hey, this is May the 15th, 2014. That's right. And it's the 15th, and I hope you've got your donation for the show in, because this is our cutoff date each month. We're going to try to keep this as a regular process so we can keep things straight. So if you find yourself not getting the show, get on the ball and send your donation in, okay? Righto, and then we'll give you your password. Well, we've been getting lots of rain there in the Midwest. Lots of rain. I doubt whether any of the farmers are going to be able to get into their fields to plant and plow and all the things they got to do. And better start drying out a little bit. However, a lot of rain is generally good for the agricultural people. Sure a lot better than a lot of places where I guess they're burning up, you know. I think I heard that Oklahoma was really, really burning up. With, of course, we got calls from my kids. I've got four kids and some grandkids in the San Diego area, and we were in communication with those people all evening and watching the Channel 8 and Channel 10 television news on the internet, and boy, sounds to me like there may be some. It's not just the heat; it's very hot, 100 degrees out there. But I wouldn't doubt that they don't find several bits of arson going on here, the way that fire hopscotched around. It very strange because those fires, and they were all the way up there to my old stomping ground, Fallbrook. They had all the people south of Fallbrook going up to the local high school to hang out. So far, I guess it hasn't gotten close to the actual town of Fallbrook. So anyhow, no matter where you go, there's some kind of problems. The tornadoes down in the southwest and the south, and heavy rains and fires, and now do you believe global warming? I'm afraid I had to change my position on global warming. Yeah, and this situation with the glaciers melting up there at the North Pole and stuff like that. I think we got a big problem we're facing here. Now, in the wee hours, I taped a couple of things that, I get a kick out of it because it's Rogue Progressive's church night, and he goes after the religious wackos, and then I had another guy that's talking on there, so I think I'm going to run these for you and see what you think.
High school now. When he spoke before the Bible, National Bible Association, that's a group that encourages the nation's leaders to read the Bible. Green said his goals for the high school curriculum were to show that the Bible is true, literally true. Every single comma and word and phrase, it's all true. And that the Bible's impact, quote, whether upon our government, education, science, art, literature, family, when we apply it to our lives in all aspects of our life, that it has been good. All the witch burnings, all the pogroms against the Jews, all the inquisitions, all the slaughtering of the Muslims, it's all been good. Right, Kathy? Hasn't it all been good? Well, what would you know?
Oh, it's been wonderful. No, I just wanted to make sure that this is the same Hobby Lobby president who his employees to have access to the Affordable Care Act because it allowed for contraception. Meanwhile, his company's retirement plan has invested
right.
in the companies that manufacture contraceptives. I just want to make sure it's the same guy.
Oh, yeah, it's the same guy.
Okay, I'm just checking.
But hypocrisy is part of Christianity. It is a fundamental, it's a baseline, it's the foundation of Christianity is hypocrisy. Because everything that they swear to you, their avatar taught them, they disobey. Everything, every single thing. Is there anything more blasphemous than to teach so-called prosperity gospel when Jesus H. Christ himself warned against that? Doesn't matter. Didn't Jesus H. Christ himself throw the money changers out of the temple? And now you have these huge mega churches where they teach this prosperity gospel. Get on your knees and pray, and you're going to be rich. And then you'll burn in hell. I mean, according to their own texts, that's hypocrisy, thy name is Christianity. Oh, and by the way, Green, Hobby Lobby President Steve Green, is a member of the Evangelical Council Road Baptist Church in Bethany, Oklahoma. He says he believes the Bible is literally true and that he is obligated to share the gospel. Oh, and by the way, he owns 500 Hobby Lobby stores and he closes them on Sunday because Hobby Lobby President Steve Green believes the Sabbath is Sunday and it's a day of rest and everyone should be able to go to church. Steve Green and his efforts to force everybody to accept his brand of very, very brutal, violent evangelical Christianity that is based in lies and hypocrisy. The ACLU of Oklahoma and other groups that believe in separation of church and state have already received complaints from the public in Oklahoma, given Hobby Lobby President Steve Green's remarks about the need for greater religious influence in society. Brady Henderson, who's the legal director of the state ACLU in Oklahoma, said, quote, one of the things I see in Green is a person who, because of how he's used biblical principles in his own life, is going to do what he sees as a personal commandment for him, which is to spread the gospel. And I might add, whether you want it or not. That's the catch. If Green wants to lead by example, the first thing he would do is sell off all his 500 stores, get all the cash, liquidate everything, and start giving it away to the poor, the sick, the halt, the lame, the blind, the people in prison. He would get rid of his 80-room mansion or whatever the hell he lives in. You know he lives pretty good. Get rid of the Bentley or the Rolls Royce or the Cadillac or the huge black SUV, whatever it is. Get rid of all that, Hobby Lobby President Steve Green, and do what your master told you to do. But you won't do that. And the reason you won't do it is because you're a lying, hypocritical fascist. Political fascists are pretty bad, but religious fascists, woo, watch out. A law professor at University of Oklahoma Law Center said he believes the curriculum proposed by Hobby Lobby President Steve Green crosses the line given Green's statements. The professor says, quote, when he does this current thing, when he gets the school board to act as a sovereign entity from the government, it's not free speech. It's theocracy. And that's unconstitutional. The University of Oklahoma Law Center professor also said, quote, he has a political agenda that amounts to civil disobedience against the First Amendment, end quote. So, Steve Green, you know what he's doing? He knows he's a hypocritical liar. He understands that. He knows that according to his own religion that he swears fealty to, and he makes a big show about being a public Christian, which also Jesus told him not to do, he knows that he's a liar. He knows he's a hypocrite. So what he's trying to do is, it's something that has its roots millennia ago, and that is to buy his way into heaven. That's all he's trying to do. But you see, the Bible also says, Hobby Lobby President Steve Green, that by grace are you saved, not by your works. It says that in the Bible. By grace you're saved. So all of this stuff that you're doing, trying to force your Christianity on other people, you know, coming up with your curriculum, your books, and all this stuff. You're trying to buy your way into heaven. And from what I have learned about the Bible or about the Christian faith, when you try to do that, Jesus is going to slam the door on your fingers. And then Satan will reach up and pry your ass off the door to heaven and take you down to hell and have fun. So Hobby Lobby President Steve Green, watch out. That breath you feel on the back of your neck, that's not Fat Tony Scalia getting ready to congratulate you. That's your Satan getting ready to devour you. Unbelievable stuff. The sheriff of a small county in northeast North Carolina says he's disgusted by the parents of six men who are accused of sexually abusing their sister for a decade at a private family compound. These are Christian conservative people, homeschooled, very stupid. The Perkiomen's County Sheriff, Eric Tilley, said, quote, I blame the parents for this. It's parents' responsibility to teach your children right and wrong. When you see a child doing something that is totally wrong and you don't correct them, then the child thinks it's okay. What he's talking about? Tilley and his deputies charged these six brothers, who range in age from 19 to 27, with a number of crimes related to the sexual abuse of their 16-year-old sister. The sheriff said the abuse began when the girl was 4 years old and continued until she was almost 15. The brothers, I listen to these names, the brothers are Aaron Jackson, Benjamin Jackson, Nathaniel Jackson, Matthew Jackson, John Jackson, and Eric Jackson. Good. Solid biblical name, except Eric. Charges against the brothers range from rape to sexual assault. The parents of these freaks, John, who's 65, and Nita, who's 54, also face charges of felony child abuse. The sheriff described the family as bizarre, and he said that the father is anti-government and anti-schools and very, very, you can well imagine, fundamentalist Christian. You see, you have a right to sexually violate your sister. I mean, look what happened with Lot and his daughters. You know, it's no big deal. But the allegations of abuse surfaced some months ago when Eric Jackson told the pastor at Hope Baptist Church in Wake Forest, North Carolina, about what was going on in the family, that they were all boinging their sister. He confided in his pastor, the sheriff said, and his pastor told him that was wrong and not the way normal families act. Did the pastor call the police? No, pastor didn't. After speaking with the pastor, Eric, who ratted out his rapist brothers, allegedly went to the county sheriff's office and told them that he, along with his five brothers, had been sexually abusing their sister all those years. Did the pastor do anything? Nah. All the pastor said was, hey, I don't think that's the way a normal family's supposed to be. Let's get down here and pray.
Well, I had a real juicy one about the rogue boy going off on Israel and this ragtag tribe come out of the desert and caused all this problem. Yeah, I lost the damn thing. Let's go over to the right wing here. Small R Republican, and see what they got to say.
Foreign policy, not only is it bipartisan, but it is sunk into the establishment. It is buried in the establishment. So deep that there is no hope of extrication. Just one more reason why alternatives to trying to reform our state of affairs must be sought if there is to be any sort of a reform. Speaking of, you know, Eric, the other day we were talking about the last week there was the election in North Carolina for the right to face Kay Hagan in the Senate election in November. And our friend, one of our three amigos, Greg Brandon, Dr. Greg Brandon, was in that race. And Brandon said here on the show that day that certain individuals had poured millions of dollars into the campaign during the waning hours for the competition, which was the establishment candidate, as they called him, Tom Tillis. Now, this is in reading around about this yesterday, because this is what I was writing about, I found a piece at the Politico. And I guess I had missed this a week or so ago. I found a piece at the Politico that was about the establishment striking back, the establishment striking back. There were some shocking things that I learned in this. Like, for example, take a wild guess. If I were to ask you, hey, how much do you think political consultants, Republican political consultants, they made, or they took in during the year. Now these are the ones that worked for Romney, for candidate Mitt Romney. How much do you think the consultants netted during the calendar year that was 2012? Just the ones that worked for the GOP and just the ones that worked in some capacity on behalf of the Romney campaign. Guess. Take a guess.
Could say six figures. Just go with that.
Six figures?
Maybe.
Six figures. Let's see, what's six? That's
hundreds of thousands.
In total, in aggregate.
Oh, I don't know. A million.
Dude, you're only off by a factor of 1,000.
Nice.
$1 billion. I want to repeat that to you. $1 billion. If Dr. Evil were here, he would say $1 billion. Come on, Mike, get back to bashing Obama. Why does that matter? I'll tell you why it matters. You know that Leviathan and that those creatures that give Leviathan life and the parasites that we talk about that are always suckling at Leviathan's teats and the usual suspects that make up those that are asphalt, and they're not constantly. They make their livings and their lives at that trough. Well, it's easy to see why and just how lucrative it is to do it. I mean, see, you can see the motivation, in other words. I had no idea. I knew it was in the millions. I had no idea it was in the billions. Now, listen to this. So the story is titled Revenge of the Republican Consultants. So for you people that think that you can dismantle this federal monstrosity and that these people are just going to drop their knives, forks, spoons, plates, and bowls and walk away from the dinner table, where on the middle of the table is that giant steaming cauldron that I talked about yesterday that has $3.9 trillions of dollars in it. These people are never going to walk away from this, and this is why. Revenge of the Republican Consultants. 10 of the consulting firms. Now listen, this is by Kenneth Vogel, posted at the Politico on the 17th of March of this year. 10 of the consulting firms that form the core of the push to elect Mitt Romney reaped a combined $1 billion in the process, have survived a Tea Party assault, and are again among the highest-grossing and best-positioned players in Republican politics. I have always told you people that the Republican Party does not care about you, does not care about your stances, doesn't care about your issues, doesn't care about your little R Republicanism, doesn't care about any of the things that you and I hold near and dear. Here's what they care about. They care about winning elections. They don't care how they get to the winner's circle. They just want to get to the winner's circle. How you get there is just, well, it's just making sausage, man. Nobody wants to see how that's done, but we just got to get there. Our kids, we got to get in there. Of course, you have to have some public face that says, we're different from those guys. We would never, whatever they did, we wouldn't do that. When, in fact, they do, they just don't do it with the same pomp and circumstance that the other side does it. But make no mistake about it. Politics today, two-party system is actually a one-party system, and it is a huge business. Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars per year. That may seem impossible or improbable, but think about it. And, of course, the two parties are only too happy to continue this ruse that there actually is a difference among them and that there is this war that's going on for the heart and soul of America. There's a war going on, all right. It is for the wallet and bread of the American people. The firms and now listen to this. The firms and their consultants have been paid more than $19.6 million for the 2014 campaign work in January of this year alone. Hey, what do you do for a living?
I get people.
Why don't you tell someone what you do? Well, I work in politics. Oh, you're a legislator. Oh, no. You're a legislator.
What do you do?
What I do is redirect the resources of very wealthy individuals towards not-so-wealthy individuals who would fail miserably at business but can succeed marvelously at this game we call politics. $19.6 million in the month of January alone. These are just the consultants that worked for Romney. So I would ask my friends in the Tea Party, including the gentleman that called me yesterday to scream at me at the end of the program, what do you propose to do about that? What do you address that? Let me clue you in, or let me just give you my take on that. There is no way to address that. Once the money gets inside, once the money is under the tent, and then the process of politics and of politicking becomes about dividing the money up, well, then that's it. The game is over. There is no way to change it or alter it. The only way that you can change it or alter it is to leave it, divorce it. You have to leave it. You got to walk. You have to walk away from it. Because then after the political class that I'm talking about here that devours, and I'm not saying that they're not providing some service for it. Please do not misunderstand. But these people would actually have to be in the employ of doing things that are actually productive. Meaning, instead, what is their productivity? What is their product? Their product is serving us, Barack Obama. That's their product. Is that a productive endeavor? Well, if you sit where I sit, I'd say no. Their product is serving us. Well, let me just throw one out here. Senator John Cornyn. Is that a productive product? Well, from where I sit, I'd say no. Their product is, insert politician here. Is that something that is productive for civil society? In most instances, the answer is going to be no. Now, it's wonderfully productive for people who live off of the wealth redistribution and the redirection of resources that the end result necessitates or brings about. It's wonderful for those people. For you and I, the ones that are on the giving end, not so much. Not so much. So there was an entire class of people. Angelo Codavilla wrote about this in his The Ruling Class essay back in 2009. We talked about this back in 2009 on the show for weeks. We actually had Codavilla on the program. People, and he wrote about how they go to the same schools, speak the same language, go to the same party, live in the same neighborhood. They pretend that they're on opposite sides of the fence when the cameras are on and people are recording things. But then they go back, like so many of the senators that don't have actual homes in D.C., but have apartments and they're roommates with each other. On C-SPAN during the day, they are mortal enemies, but at night, they're beer buddies. At night, they're sitting around watching reruns of the Golden Girls together. The point is that there is definitely a we are most certainly possessed of a monarchy of sorts. And that monarchy is most certainly has engendered a supporting cast of corrupt, tyrannical aristocrats. That's the point. Just as George Mason predicted, before the Constitution even left Washington's desk on the 15th of September, 1787. Mason gave a speech that said, man, you guys tried really hard. I'm really proud of you. It was a really good effort, but I'm not going to sign that thing. Georgie Poo, why not? Why won't you sign it? Come on, baby, sign. We need you. And Mason delivered a speech, the notes of which you can still find find today. As a matter of fact, you'll find them when Daily Caller piece is published later today. They are actually in the spirit of 76, my movie. Mason rose and said, look, I'd love to give this work my approbation, but I can't, because what you've done here is create something that is going to be abused. And I would sign it and give you all of my support, but I can't because, and it's not because I doubt the guys in this room or the rest of the founding fathers. It's because I doubt the ones that are going to come after us. And boy, did he have good reason to doubt them, and boy, have all of his doubts been verified. We're into this story here. The web gets even more engorged with money and deceit. The firms of Romney's digital director, Zach Moffitt, and political director Rich Beeson, Targeted Victory and FLS Connect, respectively, as well as the firms that made huge sums buying ads in 2012 for Karl Rove's American Crossroads, helped establishment favorite Bradley Byrne defeat a Tea Party primary rival and then a Democrat in a closely watched 2013 Alabama special congressional election. Targeted Victory, FLS, and a handful of other Romney-linked firms are also working for Senators John Cornyn, Mitch McConnell, Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, the Republican National Committee, the Republican Congressional Committee, and a variety of establishment-oriented super PACs like Karl Rove's American Crossroads. While the FLS and the firm of Romney's top strategist, Stuart Stevens, helped New Jersey Governor Chris Christie win re-election. Quote, people are either doing good work or they're not. And if they're not, the market will ultimately correct itself. Close quote, said Moffitt, whose firm was paid $100 million in 2012 and has collected $3 million in fees through January, according to filings with the Federal Election Commission. Now, folks, I could easily talk about the firms that were set up by former Majority Leader Tom Daschle, by those snakes, those serpents that worked for the Clinton administration that are still out there, the ones that Hillary funneled the ones that Hillary's going to funnel hundreds of millions, if not $1 billion, to. So this is a bipartisan endeavor. Bipartisan endeavor here. And it just helps to illustrate and I think, prepare you for the enormity of the task that is at hand, and at the same time ought to temper and chasten us to the possibility that the war, if there indeed is a war, and I don't think that there is, but if you were to wage a war against this, of the not-so-real possibility that you would be victorious in it. There's so much at stake here, and this has been built up over such a long period of time that it's almost hereditary now. This, in short, ladies and gentlemen, if you're driving, pull over. If you're standing, sit down. In short, this is the American system now, like it or not. This is what we're stuck with.
It's astonishing, and it's almost as if these political operatives in D.C. and around in this area, they have their own little world. They the things that they talk about on CNN or on the Meet the Press in the morning, I always wonder when I hear a politician talking, how many American people are actually interested in what, you know, Mitt Romney's press guy has to say to David Gregory in the morning? It's like nothing. They don't care. They're not coming to the table talking about, you know, oh well, if we really push the economy this year, or if we take a stab at Obama's job record, that'll do them in. Most American voters aren't thinking about any of the issues that these so-called consulting experts know what they're talking about.
Do the experts know what they're talking about?
Well, they act as if they do, and maybe, well, they may have the best means of getting their message out there and figuring out a way to solidify the message so that it's simpler, but I really you know, you go out afterwards and you talk to your friends over a beer or something, and, you know, they're what, like 15 days behind the last election news? So for me, it's enraging because I got to follow it the whole time. But I'm sitting there talking to them. I'm like, oh well, I forgot. They're not in the political world at all. And this world that exists off to the side of while everyone else is just trying to work and make money, and these people are just sitting in a room having meeting after meeting. I mean, you listen to I read Mark Halpern and the other guy's book Double Down, and they were talking about meetings they had, and I'm like, they're not talking about anything. They're writing down ideas on how we're gonna attack our opponent in this next race. And nothing's getting done. Nobody is doing anything.
Now, when you say no one is doing anything, what is the thing that they would be doing? This is what is just, This is what is outrageous, infuriating to me. As a matter of fact, Eric, do you remember the day, I think I have the audio clip here, do you remember the day that Dwayne Stovall, one of our three amigos, the day after he lost in his bid to unseat John Cornyn for the right to run against whatever whoever the Democrats are going to put up in the Texas senatorial election in November 2014 or coming up here. Do you remember the day after Stovall called? Do you remember that? Remember that little speech that he gave?
Which one? The Democratic nominee?
No. When Dwayne Stovall called here, and he said, look, Mike, I want to tell y'all what I learned running for this office. I want to tell you.
Well, anyhow, there you go, boys and girls. That's a little from the so-called progressive left, and to the, and to some from the Republican little R there, man. And everybody knows. Everybody that wants to know knows about all the corruption and the whole smear, and it's time for a guillotine party. That's right, a guillotine party. I'm sorry I lost that clip from Rogue Progressive, because he went after Israel like you wouldn't believe. Well, boys and girls, I have an announcement to make. My kids have been running from the fire out there in Southern California. Of course, I have four in the San Diego area, and some grandchildren there too. They've all had to leave their homes and apartments, and they're hanging out in a motel right now waiting for things to calm down. So some of the people who get the show by password are going to have a little problem today, because the webmaster is not near the equipment to where we can take care of that problem. But anyhow, we're going to send the show out. The show must go on, right? The show must go on. They have 9 separate fires going out there. You think that's an accident? Well, maybe one was. They said a car burned up along the road. I don't think 9 fires, major fires, in different locations are an accident. As far as I know, Riverside County and Orange County, that's right north, under the same temperature problems of 100 degrees, as far as I know, there are no fires up there. So, Al-Qaeda, they just run across the border there and tossed a road flare and went home, probably. Or if they didn't, I don't know why they haven't done stuff like that. Sort of embarrassing for Homeland Security, that's supposedly and spending billions of dollars and independently run, supposedly guarding against Al-Qaeda or whoever. Oh, man. Well, I heard the ex-ambassador to Russia blowing off on the radio today. Incidentally, he's a professor at a West Coast university, and he was bragging about how he was holding these secret meetings with the homosexuals in Russia and the LGBT or whatever people, and was in big support of them, which I'm sure didn't make Mr. Putin very happy. Meddling in the internal affairs of other countries, that's what we do best. Amazingly enough, our weather is going from pretty hot down tonight to around 32 degrees. Can you believe it? Wow, we're like on a roller coaster around here when it comes to weather. Well, they were going to put this black inmate to death down in Texas, but he got a last-minute day of execution due to mental disability. Well, hell, then they all could get, all the blacks could get a stay of execution based upon that. Yeah. Well, that two-faced Obama, our presidente, he condemns the anti-homosexual African nations, but not the Saudis. By Dr. Samori Swigert, homosexuality has become one of the most divisive issues in America. I want to address it from a different angle. I want to address the infusion of homosexuality with America's foreign policy. There you go. So Obama's okay as long as powerful Saudis have it, the same people that helped knock down the Twin Towers. Isn't it time we eliminate Saudi Arabia by any means possible? Well, you know, we asked the question, how come it took him so long to get on Donald Sterling? Well, number one, he had billions of dollars, and number two, he was a Jew. So here's a little article about that, and watch him try to slide around it again. Question: Donald Sterling has been an open, misogynistic, womanizing dirtbag for years. Why did he get a pass until now? A. I think Sterling was caught in four trends. One, our data show that sexism is a larger axis of discrimination than race and or ethnicity. I think Sterling's misogyny would have been tolerated, but not his his racism was not. Two, money interest. The players were planning a work disruption during the crescendo of the season. The potential loss in advertising, merchandising, and arena revenue made Sterling continued presence a financial risk. This does not always make the case alone, but for example, Mark Emmett, president of the NCAA, is making such foolish remarks that he's going to hasten college sports reforms. More on Emmett later. Number three, social media effectiveness. Going viral is now something that most Americans understand. This, too, does not always make the case. Four, I'm not getting much new stuff here, man. Senior leadership. Today's effective senior leader is very cognizant of his or her responsibility for understanding how values impact items one and two above. I don't think the NBA's last commissioner, who tolerated Sterling, would have acted as decisively as Adam Silver, who has been widely commended for his swift and firm dismissal of Sterling from the NBA community. Well, there's quite a bit more to that, but nowhere down here do they bring out that he was Jewish, and so we always give Jews a free ride as long as they can, right? They're not even going to mention he was a Jew. What does that have to do with it? What does that have to do with it? Well, Donald Sterling's wife, Shelley Sterling, has been heard saying that she has a right to hold on to her stake in the Los Angeles Clippers, and that it was sexist for the NBA to punish her for the actions of her husband. She also claimed that her husband suffers from dementia. Donald Sterling was fined $2.5 million and banned for life from the league after recordings of him were made public by his whore girlfriend, which I agree was a very cheap shot. We've gotten two or three calls to that effect, that even though he's a Jew and he's a bum and all that, for a girlfriend to secretly record private conversation and then put it out to the press is smelly. It's very, very smelly. That's what I say anyhow. Well, I hope his ex-wife gets a hold of I guess they're divorced. Shelley gets a hold of the team. But what do we care? What do we really give a shit? Come on. It's all bullshit. Well, if you're out there drinking, you better listen to this. A recent report released by the World Health Organization found that harmful alcohol consumption killed over 3 million people worldwide in 2012. Much more dangerous than marijuana or pot. And anybody seriously involved in political activity, radical political activity, should not overindulge, because it is a good way to get tripped up or a good way to get pushed into something you're not interested in. And the prisons are full of skinheads that did that very thing. To show you how white jurors treat white people differently than they do their sympathy for black people, a South Dakota judge formally sentenced a man to death for killing a woman as part of what he said was a plot to assassinate President Barack Obama. The hearing Tuesday formalized the unanimous vote of a jury to sentence 44-year-old James McVeigh to death. McVeigh would have been sentenced to life in prison without parole if the jury's decision had not been unanimous. And I'll bet they were almost all white, too. McVeigh pleaded guilty but mentally ill to murder in 2011, stabbing of a 75-year-old Maybelle Shine. McVeigh said he killed Shine and stole her car as part of his plan to drive to Washington and kill the president. He was later arrested in Madison, Wisconsin. Shine's family declined to speak during the hearing. Prosecutors McVeigh and his defense team also did not comment. Quote, "I don't have a lot to say here," said Circuit Judge Peter Lieberman. "This is a situation where a jury's verdict is a lot more weight, has a lot more weight than what I could say." Now, he still might get there'll be an appeal. He still might get off with life. But with a plan like that, he's probably correct. It was nuts. Well, finally, we got a decent judge. Assam Taylor, a black man, has been accused of being a deadbeat dad. In January 2013, then 35 years old, he was told by a judge in Ohio that he was banned from having any more children. Judge James Walther gave Taylor a 5-year ban from having any more children and told him that he had to prove that he was financially stable and providing for the 4 children, that he already owes almost $100,000 in child support. The judge was so disgusted by Taylor's lack of care about the child and support that he made this ruling. The question is the judge right or wrong for banning Taylor from reproducing? Is he infringing on his Negro rights? Taylor will be in prison for a year if he violates the judge's order. Taylor's lawyer, Doug Merrill, feels that this is taking away his client's right to procreate. Well, thank you, Judge. Take the right to procreate away from all male Negroes. Please, please. Well, we got a phony State Department, I'll tell you that. As the world pays attention to the estimated 300 missing black Nigerian schoolgirls who were abducted by an extreme Islamic group, they forget that right here in the United States there are over 64,000 African-American women and children who remain missing. 64,000! Over the years, studies have repeatedly shown that missing minorities, or non-whites, or Negroes, don't garner the same media attention as their white counterparts. Well, guess why? Because the white counterparts care. And a good share of people in the ghetto don't care. People just disappear. Bye-bye. Critics allege that mainstream media shows preference to white women and children who are reported missing. Good. That's great. Keep it up. A 2010 report shows that out of the 692,944 persons missing, and that's getting up there not too far from a million, over 273,985 of them are non-whites. So over a quarter of a million non-whites are missing. Maybe the black KKK got them. And out of that number, an astonishing 85% are Negro Americans. There are many factors as to why the cases of these black women go unnoticed, partially because most of them were prostitutes working the street. One determining factor is the missing Negro Americans are usually from a lower economic status. Well, of course, the ruling class doesn't care anything about the poor whites or blacks. Another factor, according to Mail Online, is that there is a lack of diversity in the newsrooms. Oh, it's a conspiracy in the newsrooms. Oh, man. So the Negro American community is not properly reflected when it comes to reporting the news. Well, seems to me I see more and more black faces on the news. And who needs black faces when you got white progressives on there? They bleed more for black people that are missing than anybody else, more than even black people. But now we got something new. Fortunately, a new campaign has been launched to highlight the thousands of missing Negro American women and children. The organization, the Black and Missing Foundation, has teamed up with TV One Network to make a television news series titled Find Our Missing. Their aim is to tell the stories behind the women's disappearances. Black and Missing Foundation was founded in 2008. Well, there you go. You got a job cut out for yourself. I think most of those people were stuffed in barrels and they're at the bottom of the river someplace. What do you think? Actually, I think it must have been the Black KKK. They're the only ones with the power in the ghetto to do all that stuff, man. White KKK couldn't sneak in there and do that. Well, I see where most of the Negro women disappeared to. Families for Justice as Healing is holding the Free Her Rally in Washington, D.C. The rally hopes to bring women, families, and supporters together to raise their voices against mass incarceration and the war on drugs. According to Corrections.com, the female population in prisons has risen at an astonishing 757% from 1977 to 2005. Most experts believe that massive increase is the result of tougher sentencing laws and record number of drug offenders. A majority of these women are imprisoned for nonviolent crimes. 70% of incarcerated women are usually caregivers prior to their incarceration. Wow. So that's where most of those black women disappeared to. Well, that's an interesting answer. Well, the guy's come forward, Ron Stanworth, a police sergeant out there in, where's he at? Colorado? Police sergeant chronicles his experience as an undercover KKK member. And he's a black man. Boy, this doesn't speak too highly for the KKK.
If looks could kill, I would not be sitting here talking to you today.
You wouldn't believe it unless former Utah Police Sergeant Ron Stallworth told you himself. In 1979, he went undercover as a black member of the Ku Klux Klan.
I did the talking on the phone. When it required a face-to-face meeting, I would send Chuck in posing as me, or as I like to refer to him as the white Ron Stallworth.
With the help of another detective while working in Colorado Springs, Stallworth gained the trust of the local KKK and convinced them to give him a membership.
They never once picked up on the fact that they were talking to two distinct different voices.
He had a card signed by David Duke himself. The Klan trusted him with their plans to commit crimes and threaten African Americans by burning crosses, something Stallworth put a stop to three times during his investigation.
One of the things I'm most proud of is the fact that no black child, no child period, ever had to wake up to the sight of a burning cross.
All documented in his recently released book, Black Klansmen, Stallworth got unprecedented access to one of America's most notorious hate groups.
Why risk your personal safety?
It was my job. It was my job.
In over 9 months, he did it so well, the KKK considered him
really
one of their most respected
members. You're a smart nigga, man.
And they took a vote. And they took a unanimous vote and determined that they wanted Ron Stallworth to become the leader of the KKK chapter because he was a, quote, loyal and dedicated Klansman.
Yeah, and David Duke came out to officially welcome him into the Klan. Oh, well, that disproves, I've been telling you, there's a black KKK. They've been doing a hell of a job in Chicago and Newark and New York City and down into Nigeria. They're doing terrific work down there. This guy was just a little more peaceful. And, of course, we don't know really what he did behind the scenes. Yeah, he's the black KKK man that David Duke even signed his membership card. And at the same time, I had lie detection equipment and everything ready to go anytime we needed to check somebody out. And I was still in the Klan in 79. Boy, I'll tell you, he would have never made it into my group. Mod, these black fraternities are getting out of line, man. They're getting out of line. Let's see what they're doing.
Last month, a member of a black fraternity at the University of Central Arkansas was arrested for hazing after four of their pledges came forward and filed complaints of being paddled on the buttocks repeatedly, assuming a plank position while being slapped in the face and being pelted with raw eggs while kneeling on uncooked rice. Controversies and lawsuits over hazing are beginning to threaten the future of black Greek organizations. So can black fraternities adapt and survive? And if they can change, what does change actually look like?
We have a very troubling landscape before us, especially within the legal context, right? That hazing has been persistent in black Greek led organizations. It seems to be getting more violent, at least since the 1950s.
Is you a black Greek?
There's increasing litigation. There's always the possibility that the small number of insurers that provide insurance coverage to BGLOs will drop us. And then once that happens, where do we go? We have to self-insure, and most of the organizations don't have the capital to not end up in bankruptcy. So the picture looks bleak, basically.
You say the picture is bleak, and you even offer a list of organizations, and you say certain organizations are more likely to end than others. I mean, over the next 25 years, how did you come to that determination?
One is the amount of litigation against the organizations, especially with regard to the fraternities and the amount of sort of hyper-masculinity and how that sort of feeds into the hazing. Dr. Jones can speak to any amount of capital that the organizations have on hand, and if they lose their insurance coverage, those that don't have much capital aren't going to last.
Nationally, all of our organizations are interested in the solution because nobody wants to see, you know, the ultimate dissolution of any of these organizations. These organizations mean so much to our community. They mean so much to the members.
So I don't think
that the issue is that they're not necessarily interested in it. I think that what it comes down to is there's, I think, sort of what George alluded to earlier, there's a disconnect between, you know, what's taking place on a national level and the leadership on a national level and individuals and individual chapters. And I think what it's coming down to is an individual feeling that you need to do something to gain access into this organization.
Is that a problematic idea to have?
I don't think it's a problematic idea to have. I think coming into especially in an undergraduate situation, I think coming into school, you have this idea that, you know, here are these organizations with these legacies and this history, and a lot of, you know, individuals who join, a lot of members, a lot of people who are seeking membership are doing so because of whatever stories, whatever history they've heard from parents, you know, relatives, family members, friends, and they're coming in with particular expectations. And so I think really what we need to do is find a way to bridge that gap and to work to, you know, to have individuals at the chapter level and individuals at the national level work together in order to come to some sort of understanding where we have a process where people are, you know, respectful of what's going on, but also respectful of individuals' lives and safety, because that's where we're having a major disconnect.
People always say they want this rigorous thing that's nonviolent, but it becomes very nebulous and it ultimately becomes violent.
So I think that's what is a major issue, because in addition to the disconnect between, you know, especially at the undergraduate levels, between, you know, undergraduates and graduate members, you have an issue of this gap between paper and who pledged. And that's a major issue there, because what it comes down to is how hard did you go? How hard did you pledge? And if you didn't pledge, then you're automatically disrespected and you're automatically looked at as not really a real member of the organization. So that's another thing.
This gal is the black media director for Huffington Post, man. She's mulatto. Do you notice how fast she talks? Mulattoes really talk fast. She got a lot of white blood in her, and it's making her talk fast. She's one of those high yellow babes there with Huffington Post, and they got all kinds of problems because I think the black KKK has infiltrated the black fraternities. Yeah, and they're knocking them off and paddling them on the butt and everything. Well, I don't know. Well, this is interesting. Last week marked 1 year since the start of the trial in Munich of the last surviving member of the National Socialist Underground, the NSU. The anniversary of the start of the trial was overshadowed by the mysterious death of a long-standing German undercover agent, Thomas Richter, nicknamed Corelli. Corelli was due to appear in a Munich court to give evidence on the workings of the NSU. Between 1997 and 2007, Richter Corelli was an undercover agent for the German Secret Service, Office for the Protection of the Constitution. We need that here, protection of the Constitution. Some sources claim he worked for the Secret Service even longer, for a total of 18 years. From 1994 until his unmasking in 2012, according to the newspaper Bild am Sonntag, during this period he received 180,000 euros for his services. He must have been aware of the activities of the NSU at an early stage. He mentioned the terror group in a contribution he wrote for a far-right magazine in 2012. Or 2002. The circumstances of his death are sketchy. According to Spiegel Online, a representative of a security authority found the body of the 39-year-old, on April 3rd at his home near Paderborn. The Attorney General's Office and the Federal Criminal Police deny any involvement in the discovery of the corpse, while the BFV and the Interior Ministry have declined to give any information. Corelli had been living under the BFV Witness Protection Program since 2012. How's that working out for you, Mr. Corelli, after he was unmasked as a longtime undercover agent from within the far-right milieu in the summer of the same year? Only a handful of officials could have been aware of his location and his new identity. Talk about lone wolves, infiltration. The official cause of his death was a sugar shock triggered by an allegedly unknown diabetes condition, according to numerous media reports citing security circles. An autopsy failed to find any evidence of involvement in his death by other persons. Right. If possible, that Corelli had once again come to the attention of the Secret Services in recent months. At the end of February, Der Spiegel, I reported that an undercover agent had reported to the offices of the State Secret Service, LFV, in Hamburg, and had handed over a CD labeled NSU/NSDAP that he had received 8 years earlier from Corelli. The Hamburg LFV reported that handover to the Attorney General, who then ordered a search of Corelli's apartment on April 25th, a full 3 weeks after the discovery of his corpse. According to Der Spiegel, a total of about 15,000 images and text files are contained on the CD. Apparently, Corelli was the author of some of the files, while others were explicitly to the National Socialist Underground of the NSDAP. It is reported that the CD was completed in June 2006. The responsibility of the NSU for a series of 10 murders of invader workers and one police official only came to light in November 2011, following the violent deaths of two NSU members, Yui Mondios and Yui Bonhart, in an alleged double suicide. The security authorities have also repeatedly claimed they knew nothing of the existence of the group until the two deaths. Well, I think that that was probably a cop job, that they didn't commit suicide at all, but the federal agents got them. Corelli, also known as Hi J. Thami, played a central role in the far-right milieu for years. In 1998, his name was found on a contact list drawn up by Yui Mundus, so-called garage list, which contained a total of 30 names linked to the ultra-right Thuringian Homeland Security, the network from which the NSU emerged. Yui Mundus had direct contact with Corelli, according to a report compiled by the NSU special investigator of the Bundestag, Bernard von Heinzschelrig. Corelli's name also papers in connection with a German offshoot of the Ku Klux Klan active in the state of Baden-Württemberg. The KKK offshoot was founded by an official of the LFV with Corelli as a founding member. I wonder whether Dennis Mahan met up with those guys when he was over there. Maybe. A list of KKK members drawn up by the Baden-Württemberg LFV included Corelli, along with two police officers who were later active later in the unit of the police officer murdered by the LSU. To date, there has been no explanation of why the NSU should murder a German policewoman in broad daylight, although all of the other victims were invader workers. It is striking in this case that the official mugshots, which have never been made public, issued by the authorities, features persons with no resemblance to any of the NSU members. The question arises, did Corelli have knowledge about the background of the murdered policewoman and the involvement of the security forces in the far-right scene in Baden-Württemberg, which could have proved embarrassing for the state? Corelli is not the first important witness in the NSU case who has suffered a mysterious death. Last September, another spectacular death was recorded in Stuttgart. In that case, 21-year-old Florian H. burned to death in his car. On the evening of the same day, H. was due to make a statement to the Baden-Württemberg LFV on the background of the far-right milieu in the state. The boys don't play games over there in Deutschland. Shortly after the death, the police reported that Florian H. had committed suicide. Everybody commits suicide in Germany. His mother disputes the police version, for which there is no evident witnesses, had also reported that the car first exploded and only then burst into flames. Gee, that's strange. The fact that Florian H. could have been an important witness for throwing light on the NSU only became known a few weeks ago. His name appeared on a note in a final report of the investigation committee of the Bundestag. NSU, it reveals that by 2012, H. had stated that along with the NSU, there was also a second group of National Socialists, the Neo-Schutzstaffel, NSS. Representatives of both groups had met once near Heilbronn. After Florian H., Thomas Richter, alias Corelli, is now the second most important witness into the links between the NSU and the state security forces to die under dubious circumstances. Yeah, how you like those lone wolves? Pretty good, huh? Next time you run into a cop and you shake his hand, make sure he gives you the right handshake or another man done dead. Like the song Maria Laveau by Bobby Bear. That's about it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Tomorrow is what? Friday? What is today? Wednesday? Wait a minute. Tomorrow is Friday. Yeah. So that's it. This is the 15th, May the 15th, 2014, and we got a full moon out there tonight. Yeah, how about that? 14-5, and just remember, if you don't give the right handshake to the right cop, he may be one of us. Ho, ho, ho.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds if we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet.
14.5.